Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Jody Peterman. We know that no one understands what you need better than you do. We take care to guide you through the legal process, ensuring that you're able to make the decisions that are best for you. If you have a personal injury, criminal, or family law issue, please take a look at our website to learn more about our practice. We offer a free initial consultation for personal injury cases. Give us a call at 229-375-5680. We have a reputation for being accessible and treating our clients well. We look forward to hearing from you.
Hello, I'm Guy Terry of Terry and Peterman. At Terry and Peterman, we are committed to representing the hardworking residents of South Georgia in personal injury, criminal, and family law matters. For years, we have worked with college students in this area to ensure legal issues do not disrupt their academic careers. We also represent military families struggling with divorce and family law issues. We rely upon over 30 years of combined experience to provide aggressive representation for our clients.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. This is Rich Tate. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jay West, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons. How you guys doing tonight?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Bobby?
I'm doing good. No complaints.
All right. Jay?
Well, let's see here. I'm on pain meds, so I may be a little more entertaining than usual, which is probably nil, having a little surgical procedure tomorrow. But I'm here. Glad to hear from everybody.
Well, nothing serious, I hope.
Compressed disc in the back, you know, from carrying too many speakers when I didn't have roadies and wearing the old Les Paul for too many years. It's just finally caught up with me.
I get that. guys, anybody heard from Mike Norris? How's he doing?
Michael's doing fine. He's progressing very slowly.
He had just gone into rehab our last show.
Well, after he got into rehab, he's managed to take a few steps. Of course, using the aid of the parallel bars, he's managed to walk 4 or 5 steps. He's been able to stand up some. He's doing his exercises and working on a cross trainer every day to get the muscle tone back. He told me that the doctor told him that he could actually feel the muscle coming up in the back of his leg. And I told him, I said, if you're going to have a muscle when you come out of there, you're better off than when you went in. So he's doing well. He's still having some issues with his blood pressure going up and down. But he's doing well. He looks great. He's lost about 130 pounds, and he's doing good.
I've seen some pictures of him. He does look looks very good.
Yeah, he does.
He said his goal is to walk out of this place by the end of April.
Right.
So that's I'm hoping he can stick to that.
Awesome. He'll be staying up here in Atlanta, right?
He'll be living with me.
Okay.
He's going to be with me for a while. Don't know how long, but he'll be. We've already changed his address to my address, so he'll be staying here with me for a while.
The Odd Couple.
Yes. I can use some companies because one thing did happen, and I understand it's a lot of people don't understand and think it's crazy, but my cat passed away 2 weeks ago.
Oh, Bobby, no!
And Punk was my hold on a lifeline. I guess he was 15 years old, and I had had him. We bottle fed him. We got him before his eyes were open, and me and Debbie raised him. And he was fine on Thursday, and on Friday he got sick, and by Sunday he wasn't eating anything, and I took him to the vet, and he lasted 4 days, and his kidneys just quit working, and here again, the good Lord heard my prayer. I didn't have to put him down. He just passed away on his own very peacefully. He just went to sleep, and that was the end of it. But
very much the way the other cat went, right?
Yeah, pretty much the same way. But I've had a very lonely house for 2 weeks. So
I bet. Well, I've got about 10 that eat on
my
porch.
No, thank you. No, thank you. My goddaughters had just gotten 2 kittens, and I took everything I had, and I packed it up and took it to them. I cannot go through this heartache again.
I understand.
So, but he was my buddy for 15 years. He was more like a dog than he was a cat. He took every step I took, and you would not believe how many weeks I've done this radio show with him laying in the middle of my chest.
I'm sure.
So, anyway, but, yeah, we're moving on. We're doing okay.
Absolutely sympathize. I had a cat for about that long that passed away just a few years back. And, yeah, you can get connected to your animals. You definitely can. They are part of the family.
Punk did not know he was a cat. He thought he was a kid in cat clothes. I mean, he was so spoiled it was unreal. But he, you know, you get very attached to him standing at the door waiting on you when you come in and sitting with you till you go to bed, and then when you go to bed, they jump into bed and sleep at the foot, at your feet all night. I mean, it's just, it was very, I'm not sure there is a good way. I'm just glad he didn't get sick and suffer a long time. He just, you know.
Amen.
Well, Bobby, I've got 4 dogs and 3 cats, so I'll be more than happy to send them down your way for a while.
I understand. A lot of people have offered to help, but I know thank you.
Well, guys, we've covered 5 classes of the Hall of Fame so far in this series, and we're getting good feedback on it. No reason to stop now. Might as well keep going. We're going to talk tonight about the class.
Rich, before we go on to that, I noticed on Facebook today that our friend Jeff McGowan was having some surgery on his knee. Thought I'd mention that and hope things go well with him and his family there.
Yeah, absolutely. Has Jeff been refereeing lately?
No. He hurt his leg playing basketball. Wink, wink.
Okay.
As you know, hospitalization frowns on referees and wrestlers, but they don't mind playing basketball. So he heard it playing basketball, tore his ACL, and he was over at what used to be the Dr. Andrews Clinic there in Birmingham today. I talked to Scrappy. Scrappy called me, and they were doing it arthroscopically, and he was coming home tonight after he got out of recovery. So he may be home or on the way home even as we speak.
All right, good news. All right, so 2008, we're going to kick this off by talking about a promoter that pretty much ran things in Savannah for a number of years. I've got him dating all the way back into the 1950s. We're going to let Jerry lead this one. Jerry, talk about Aaron Newman.
Well, it could take all night, but I'll make it brief. He was he was somebody that loved what we did as much as we did. I know he started in the 50s when my wife was just a kid. And he started off in a very, very small arena. It was called a little arena. And then he built the arena here in Savannah. I think he had seated like 2,600, 2,400, something on that order. And, of course, that was the only place you could have any big event. He even brought Elvis there and had all kind of, you know, promoted shows there, and he loved the business. He, you know, he expanded his building and had it many, many years and drew a lot of money there. He did well, especially when Leo was here. They would pack that place to the rafters. I mean, it was unbelievable. And he always stuck up for the boys. You know, he used to battle Dunkel about paying the guys more money coming all the way from Atlanta all the way down here to Savannah, and always had to butt heads with Ray about stuff like that. And he's the only promoter that I ever wrestled for that when the world champion was here, before the champion got in the ring, he would always put down a fresh, brand-new, clean canvas for the world title match. And I thought that was, you know, it just made it seem a little more important, you know.
You're not kidding.
And, you know, he promoted through the years, and he got caught up in the split and got some death threats. And I got a letter that he was going to kill me, and, I mean, it was stuff that people never heard about. I mean, it was just awful. It was just awful, you know. And he hung on, you know, for a long time, and then, you know, when the Georgia thing was done, then he promoted Savannah for Charlotte. When we were in Charlotte, we came down. He was still promoting then, and then he just finally faded out. But I never saw a promoter that loved the business as much as him to have never actually, you know, got in the ring and wrestled. But he was a good man. He was a very good promoter.
A few things I want to add to that. Since you didn't mention it, and some of our listeners may be interested in this, and they may not know it, he was actually your father-in-law.
He's my father-in-law, right.
Right. Now, the part you talk about Charlotte, that actually took place in 1976. Just to clarify, that wasn't after McMahon in Georgia in 84. That was actually in 76, just to get that out there. And he promoted into the 80s now, didn't he, with working with Charlotte?
Yes. Yes, he did. And it was a weird thing here. You know, they eventually built the Civic Center here, and they moved it. They wanted to move the matches to the Civic Center, and it was never the same. we've talked before about buildings with atmospheres, like the Bell Auditorium in Augusta just had that atmosphere. Atlanta City Auditorium had its own atmosphere, you know. And that sports arena here, it just had its own atmosphere. It was a great wrestling venue for, you know, for here. But once they ever moved it to the Civic Center, it was never the same. It didn't draw like it used to. And I don't know if the building had something to do with it or the change in other times, the bookers or talent or whatever. But
where the building was located had something to do with it. The fact that
exactly.
It was a cavernous, huge, high ceiling. It was like working in a warehouse. And,
exactly.
And yeah, never. I mean, it was just, and you know, in all the years I went there, I only saw the building full one time. And that was when Ray Candy got married in the ring.
And that was probably the biggest wrestling crowd ever, Bobby, until, you know, later on.
It may very well have been. But it was just the building was just not, it was not conducive to
it just, there was no atmosphere.
None whatsoever.
It just didn't do. And he had a brother that lived in Washington, D.C., and he went up to Washington. He went to the wrestling matches. He's promoting here. And he met Bobo Brazil, and he asked Bobo would he be interested in coming to Georgia. He said, well, I've never been to Georgia. He said, I've never been asked to come there. He said, well, I'm going to talk to him and get you down here. He got Bobo's number and all that, so he called Bobo. I mean, he come back, you don't want to bring him, you know, this and this and this and this. This was pretty good while back. So he brought him. Sold the place completely out. Bobo had never been here. Packed the place. So then other people, the Atlanta office started using him. They heard what kind of house he drew, and then, you know, everybody else here in the state started bringing Bobo. But the one funny story, the second time he was going to bring him, it was a little while later, Bobo called him. He said he was coming out of Washington, D.C., and it was like, I don't know, 6:30 then. He said, the weather's bad up here, and I hadn't left yet. And so he said, I'm going to get in like at 10:05. That's when, you know, I'm going to leave. And they said we would arrive at 10:05. So the place is sold out. My wife's, she's got the concession. She's running concession. Her dad, he's sweating bullets. The place is sold out. So he told, Mr. Newman told his brother, he said, I'm going to pick up Bobo Brazil. And if he don't get off that plane at 10:05, I'm not coming back. You do whatever you want. You tell these people. You make up some kind of tale, but I am not coming back to this building. So he finally got him to the building like it. 20 minutes to 11.
Whoa.
Bobo was changing clothes in the car, and they pulled it off. You know, of course, they had to stretch the matches, and people were getting restless, and, you know. But that was to have heard him tell that story, I mean, it almost make you cry. He said he was not coming back to that arena.
I don't blame him. I wouldn't have either.
Jerry, was he? What business was he in? Was he a wrestler before he got into promotion, or was he?
No, he never wrestled. He never. No, he owned the largest sheet metal and roofing business in this town at one time, and he's very good at making and build. He built a lot of rings. He built a lot of rings for the Carolinas. He built some for here in Georgia. And
built a wonderful ring.
The ring I had in Columbus, that was the last ring that he had built. And I had that ring in Columbus, and meant a lot to me. But he never stepped foot in the ring. Never. Never. He was a good promoter. He was a very good, very good promoter.
How did he actually just end up getting into the business?
How he got into business, he owned a building over there where his shop was. He had a huge shop on the other side, Bobby. I don't know if you ever paid any attention to where that building was on the other side. He had this huge shop. He had like, I don't know, 60 guys working for him. I mean, he did major jobs here in Savannah. And he had that little arena. And a guy named Chick Witt, I don't know if you've ever heard that name.
Yeah.
You've heard it?
Yeah, well, we've got some of his shows up in our database, yeah.
And he was a promoter, and he rented that building from Mr. Newman, the little bitty. I mean, it was little. I mean, they called it a little arena. And so Mr. Newman rented him that building, and he just decided he wanted to get out of it. So Mr. Newman made arrangements with him in Atlanta, and he started promoting in the little arena, and, you know, he loved it. He loved it. And then that's when he went and built the sports arena. And so it just took off from there. And, I mean, he loved it. We used to wrestle. He promoted Statesboro, Savannah, Jekyll Island. He ran a lot of spot shows like Bobby O'Neill made those towns, Surrency.
He ran Waycross, too.
Ran Waycross on a weekly basis.
Yep.
Surrency, a lot of small towns around. All those spot shows did great.
Yep.
You know, coming off TV.
This appraisal of Mr. Newman coming from Jerry is very biased. You understand that, Rich? I mean, this is a very one-sided. His wife's probably standing there over the top of him. Let me tell you, the only time I ever wanted to kill Mr. Newman, and Jerry's appraisal of him is very right. He was a wonderful, and he was elderly when I was working for him. He had done got up in years, but he was a wonderful gentleman to be around. He's the one that took me to he ran Beaufort, South Carolina one time, and he took me to Fort what's the place where they trained the Marines? Paris Island. He took me to Paris Island with him. And he knew the guy that run Paris Island, the general or whatever he was. And I remember riding over in the car with him, and it was pouring down rain, and we rode down through there, and there was a guy, one of them recruits had done something wrong. And they had this recruit standing outside one of them Quonset huts watering the dirt. He had a water hose running. He was watering the dirt. And raining, God, it was raining. And they told us when he got through, they said that they would make him clean up the walkway where he splattered mud on it. Oh, it was... But the only time I ever thought about shooting him, he ran Fort Stewart.
Yeah, he used to run Fort Stewart.
And I took the ring down there. Well, of course, when you get down there, you got 25 soldiers want to help you put the ring up. And when the matches was over, them soldiers went away. And I had to tote that ring probably 50 yards to the back of that truck and load it by myself. And I'm looking for Mr. Newman, and he was halfway to Savannah. I thought I'm going to shoot him next time I see him. But yeah, he was great to work for. He was fun to be around. He was funny. He was funny.
Hey,
had
Jerry,
a great sense of humor.
Jerry, you were talking about Chick Witt, and I'm going to get educated now because I'd never known. We were doing the research on the arena that he was running. The newspaper was calling that place the Barn. And you're referring to it as the little arena, and I guess that's probably a nickname for it or whatever. But any idea why they were calling it the Barn? I mean, was there an actual official name for that venue?
Uh, all my wife ever told me, the little arena, and I don't know when Chick went, when he started, Rich. I never met the man.
Well, I've got him in 1957, and then it was shortly after a few shows with his name attached to it, that's when Aaron Newman started showing up. So it's kind of, I just figured you might be able to elaborate on that name, because the newspaper, it just says Barn. You know, I mean,
I have no idea. I'll have to ask her when we get off the air. But he was the only promoter that ever gave guys Christmas presents. He would give you an envelope with a Christmas card in it, it'd be $10 in there.
Cool.
And that don't sound like much, but it was $10, you know.
Hey, when the guarantee was 15, it was a pretty good stroke. I mean, me and Charlie Smith was talking about that the other day. We went to Dublin. I went to an independent show with him down in Dublin, and we were talking, and we were talking about going down 16, going towards Savannah, and we talked about how many times we would leave Atlanta at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, drive 4.5 hours down there because you had that two-lane road part of the way, and then you'd work. You'd get there an hour before the show, work the matches, take a shower, get out of there 30, 45 minutes after it was over, and then drive 4.5 hours home and make $15. And when we moved in that big building, there was a lot of them days.
But it was Savannah really blew open when Leo was there, and they took Steve Manderson and Mr. Newman went to Atlanta and talked to Gunkel, and they made a TV for Savannah and Augusta.
Uh-huh.
That's when the Torres brothers were here. That's when it blew wide open. I mean,
yep.
it blew wide open.
Now, were
and
they
the
both
TV,
doing their own?
Go ahead, Rich.
Were they both doing their own TV at the time? Augusta did theirs, Savannah did theirs? Or did they?
I think it was the
same
tape. Yeah, they bicycled, okay. You know. But it was geared for Savannah and Augusta, and it made all the difference in the world here. And
they'd lay the interviews into the they'd cut the interviews and lay them into the master tape,
right. And it made the difference. I mean, the Torres brothers, I guess they was the hottest team that ever hit in Savannah. I mean, people still talk about the Torres brothers here.
Oh yeah,
it was amazing. It was. And the last time New York was here, I went. Of course, Civic Center was sold out. So that's the first match I've been to, and I couldn't tell you how long.
All right, guys, next on the list.
Well, let me ask one question before I forget. Jerry,
okay.
You mentioned rings in Columbus. The ring that you had when you guys had the gym, what happened to it?
I have no idea, Bobby.
You know, that's the ring y'all came up. I don't remember. I know Ted came up. I can't remember if you came with him or not. Y'all came up to the arena, and it was laying on the yard out behind the sports arena, and I let y'all have it.
I don't know what happened to that ring, Bobby.
That ring, I don't know. I mean, I guess you do. I think I told y'all. But that ring, that was the ring from Channel 11, Live Atlanta Wrestling.
That was a good ring. I did a lot of work for it, but it was a good ring.
Remember how low it was?
Yes.
It was built low for TV. But, yeah, that was the ring we used. It was Live Atlanta Wrestling. It was the one we moved down to 17, and we used it in 17.
I think Ted Allen got that ring.
That wouldn't surprise me.
I think, Bobby, since you mentioned
it. He seemed to wind up with all of them at some point.
But I think he did. He got some from Ralph, too, in Columbus.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, Rich, what's next?
All right. Andre the Giant.
Yeah, what can you say about Andre? I mean, I tell you several. I mean, what can you say? I mean, just what a draw he was. And I know he was at Columbus TV one night, one afternoon. We did TV. I don't know how he got to Columbus. So he come to me, he said, "Boss, where are you tonight?" I said, I'm in Griffin. He said, "I need a ride." I said, "Andre, I'm driving a Toyota." He said, "That's okay, boss." Well, it wasn't okay. I mean, my God. So, well, we We made it, but it was, I never forget, we was going down 4th Avenue, the big drag, four-lane drag there in Columbus. And I was in the left-hand lane, and I pulled up. I mean, you should have seen him in there. That's when he had his afro, you know. So I pulled up beside a car at the red light. The car on my right, you know, got, he just kind of glanced over there, and you should have seen him. He took a double take. He couldn't believe what he was saying. But he, I know when I was in Louisiana, I had a van, and I would, when he would come in out there, I'd ride him for the week he was there, and it was, you could tell he was in there, brother. He'd get in the back and lay down and sleep, and he'd roll over, van would rock on down.
Yes, sir.
But he, Andre was a nice guy, you know, I really felt sorry for him. You know, he was miserable, you know, no matter what the accommodations were, he was just so big, you know, but he always treated the guys nice and got along with everybody. I never heard anybody, of course, who would fool with him, you know.
Could you imagine him getting mad at you?
No.
Jeez.
Oh, we were in Kansas City, and I think it was a battle royal. It might have been a tag match, me and Ted and Andre against somebody. It had to have been something like that. So, but all I know is they threw Ted over the top rope, and the big man was on the floor, and he caught Ted. He was on the floor, and he took Ted up over his head and threw him back in the ring like he was a child. Ted was hollering, "Who called for that? Who called for But one of the funniest stories he ever told me, I said, "Hey, Andre," I said, "over the years, has anybody ever tried to mess with you, fool with you, try to cause you in trouble?" He said, "One time, boss," he called everybody boss. He said, "I was in a bar in Montreal." See, it was kind of dim lit. He said, "I was sitting, the bar was, you know, there, and he was sitting way back." And he said, "It was kind of dim." He said, "I was sitting at a table." He says, "A man and his wife or a man and his girlfriend sitting at the bar." And he said, "These three guys come in." He said, "They started picking on this guy, you know, the guy's, you know, they speak in French." He said, "Look," he said, "I'm here with my whoever she was, and I don't want any trouble." They just kept on. I said, "How big were they?" He said, "They wasn't too big." He said, "About 6'5", 275, rough-looking guys." So he said, "One of them was leaning on the bar, and he saw Andre sitting back there in the dark. He said, "Hey, big head, what are you looking at?"
"Oh."
Andre said, this is a classic statement. He said, "If you wasn't looking at me, you wouldn't know what I was looking at." Then he said, "Hey, big head, has anybody ever tried to cut you?" He said, "I took my foot and turned that table over and got up." Well, you know, when he gets up, he keeps coming up.
Yes, sir. He fills the room up.
He said, "I beat that guy from one end of the bar to the other, and the other two were gone." He said, "That's the only time anybody ever tried to, because, you know, you have to drink a lot of liquor, say something to him."
He made a spot show one time down in South Georgia, and I wasn't with him. You'd have to get Randy, my buddy, to tell you the story. He's there, but he said they all went out to eat after the matches because they were staying over and making another spot show the next day down near the Florida line somewhere. And he said they were at an all-night restaurant. And he said they're sitting at a table, and it was him and Andre and Charlie McGowan and a couple other people. And he said some guy down at a table about four or five tables down seen Andre, and they could hear him talking because he was drinking. He was loud. He said, "Oh, I know Andre. We're personal buddies." And he kept leaning out going, "Hey, Andre, hey, Andre." And he said this went on for about 5 minutes, and Andre tried to ignore him. He said finally it got on Andre's nerves, and he said he leaned out and turned around and looked at the guy and gave him the finger. And Randy said when he gave that guy the finger, he said that finger looked like it was about 2 inches around and about 8 inches tall. And he said, "You ain't ever seen a guy get up and leave a place as fast as that guy got up and left." And said the whole time he's going out the door, said he must be in a bad mood tonight.
You know, and everybody gawked at him and it had to have been a miserable life for him, you know.
Yeah,
even though he made a lot of money, but
Well, he got a lot of media coverage. He was one of the few guys that could, you know, work the AWA one week and the next week be in an NWA area and then the next week in the WWF. But because of his size, he wasn't as big as the ring announcer would announce him as being, but he was definitely a big guy. And, of course, he was in the infamous 1976 boxer-wrestler match with Chuck Wepner that was, all over the country with the Ali Inoki match that night. And that got coverage on Wide World of Sports when nobody except Olympic wrestlers got any coverage on that show. And he was in a couple of movies, including The Princess Bride. But talking about his size, towards the end of my tenure there, at the end of 1980, we had a show at the Omni, and Andre was in one of the last matches, and I forget exactly what was happening, but there was a cage match before that, and obviously everything broke loose. And Freddie had told me that Andre was going to come out, and he was going to try to get into the ring, and I was supposed to go up and tell him, no, he couldn't get into the ring then. He had to wait till that match was over. Of course, he was, going to go in anyway. But I was supposed to do that. And then, of course, Andre was supposed to tap me. And I better sell it, otherwise it was going to be real. And so, I was scared to death. I didn't know what the guy was going to do. But it happened, and I told him, no, you can't go in. And he gave me that look and looked down at me. And, of course, the crowds loved it. And he just barely touched me with his finger. But I sold it. But just getting close to that guy, it was unbelievable, his size. And I certainly felt fortunate just to have the opportunity to work a little bit with him towards the end of what I did there. And he was quite an attraction.
I met him for the first time in 1973 in Houston, Texas. He was big, but he wasn't, and Mulligan was there, and he was bigger than Mulligan, of course, but every year I'd see him, he would be bigger and bigger and bigger. It was unbelievable. How big.
Well, he was billed as the eighth wonder of the world, and as I remembered, it was his introduction was 7 feet four, 450 pounds, and then it kept going up from that. But he was legitimately a big guy.
Yeah, that's the biggest man I've ever seen.
When I first started working with him, would have been 1975, I guess, is the first time I ever worked with him. He was, we would do a deal when I was refereeing. And the whole time I refereed, from 1972 till I actually quit refereeing full time, I never weighed over 240 pounds. I went between 220 and 240. And we did a little deal where he would pick me up and set me on the top rope in the corner. I'd try to get him to stop doing something. He'd turn around, just pick me up, take me over, and set me on the top corner. And I learned after a couple of times of doing this, it really didn't matter if I wanted to go sit on the top rope or not. He picked me up like a rag doll. Do the deal. He would turn his back on me, and I'd jump down. And when he turned around and looked at me, I'd jump right back up there. We'd do one of them deals. But he was just he could hold his hand up, and you could not, without moving your head, you could not see around his hand. It was that big. And Jerry talks about him being miserable. I think that's very much the case, because the older he got, his knees started bowing. He started actually shrinking a little bit. His weight didn't come down, but his stature did. And the last couple times I saw him on TV or on a tape where he was trying to work, it was just horrible, because you knew he was in pain.
Right. The disease he had, people did not live very lengthy times with that.
Jeez. God love him.
I know.
What a nice guy.
I know there, it was pretty close to the end when he was working just really for Vince. And they called Dr. Andrews. That's when Andrews was still in Columbus. And they flew him down there. And Dr. Andrews told me the story. He said, when I walked in that room and saw him, I thought, my God. So they x-rayed him. And Andrews, you know what Andrews told him? He said, there's nothing I can do for you. Nothing. And he like Jay said, he was in a lot of pain.
Oh,
he was in a lot, all that weight on his knees, all his cartilage gone. He was like I was, bone on bone. And I mean, they don't have a knee replacement with somebody like that, you know?
Can you imagine the machine you'd need to have, you know, the, back in those days, to have something to x-ray him with? I mean, my goodness, you know, you're not talking about a normal arm and leg you're putting in there to see what it looks like.
Yeah, exactly. But, well, if Andy's didn't do anything for him. Go ahead, Rich.
All right, next up on the list, never quite for sure, for certain how this guy's last name was spelled. I've never really heard anybody say it. I've just always called it Zaharias, Babe Zaharias, or Zaharias, I guess. I doubt seriously any of you guys ever.
Rich, you know that's a mistake. Did you know that's a mistake?
What's a mistake?
Babe Zaharias was George Zaharias' wife. Babe Zaharias was a golfer. And
yeah, well, this
George
was, this
Zaharias
was
married Babe Zaharias.
Right. That was Babe Didrikson.
Yes.
But this was Chris Davros, who wrestled as Babe Zaharias.
I did not know that. I stand corrected.
Me either.
He actually wrestled as a cousin of George and Tom, if I'm not mistaken. Now, his career spanned, at least in Georgia, in the 1940s through the 1950s. He was at one point, he hardly ever went over, but he was always in main event action with the top stars that were here locally, or the top stars that passed through town. He was always in the main or the semi-main. He wrestled for the world title at least on a couple of occasions that I can recall off the top of my head. Wrestled for the Southern title a few times. Never won any of the local championships. He died on the morning of August 9th, 1957. He was found dead in the Savannah hotel room after having worked for Aaron Newman the night before, where he substituted for Jack O'Brien in a match against Deborah McCoy. Not real sure what he died of, but he was actually believed to have died between 8:30 and 10 that morning, and he was 42 years old when he died. And I was actually wrong. He was not the cousin, but he was billed as a brother to George, Tom, and a gentleman that wrestled as Chris Zaharias, who was not to be mistaken with Chris Davros, who wrestled as the guy we're talking about. There was actually a one, two. His wife had actually written a letter to the FBI, and we're going to put that up on the website pretty soon. We've gotten a couple of letters it was Department of Justice. Back during the deal with all the big legal stuff that was going on with the NWA back in the 50s about it being a monopoly and whatnot, she wrote a letter claiming that he'd been blackballed by all the promoters in the South, listing pretty much everybody in Tennessee, Florida, Alabama, the Carolinas, and Georgia, which actually kind of does work around the fact that he wasn't wrestling in Georgia a lot at that time. I don't know about anywhere else, so I don't know how legit that was, but I always found that interesting that she would write a letter like that. Don't know much about the guy other than that. I've seen a couple of photos, never seen any footage. Didn't know if you guys had ever really heard of him, heard anything about him. So I don't know if you got anything to add.
I know where he died. He died at the Manger Hotel.
And what was the name of it?
Manger. Manger. The building is still there, but it's not a hotel anymore.
Okay.
It's downtown Savannah, on one of the squares.
Mm-hmm.
That's where Charlie Smith said the guys used to stay, right?
Yes.
The Manger said you could the room for $5, and they'd give you a late checkout.
It's still a heck of a building. I don't know what kind of hotel it was back then, but it's a super building.
So you could get a $15 payout for going down to Savannah, but you could stay overnight for $5. So basically you make 10.
Well, see, back then Savannah ran on Tuesday nights.
Right.
You'd make Augusta on Monday and then go to Savannah from Augusta. So you had to stay over.
That's what we did.
All right, next up on the list, I don't think this guy's a stranger to anybody, Buddy Colt. Huge run here in the 70s. I want Jerry to lead this one off because I'm pretty sure you guys crossed paths a few times, right?
Oh, I wrestled Buddy many, many times. I was young in the business, but I don't know why I got to wrestle him a lot, you know. And he was, I remember seeing him way before I got in the business when I was in high school. He was here as Ron Reed.
Yeah.
Cowboy Ron Reed. Then he, you know, later on, he returned as Buddy Colt. But Buddy, he, you know, I thought he was excellent. You know, he looked the part. He could talk. He was at the right place at the right time when he come back with his look and, you know, the blonde hair and the, he had a good body on him, and he did a heck of a job here. I know that he was really over. He was over in the whole state. I mean, not just one town. You know, sometimes some guys are over in two or three towns. He was over everywhere. People hated him, but he was fun to be in the ring with. You know, even I was young in the business. You know, he never guzzled you or nothing. You know, he let you do your thing, and he was good. He really was. I enjoyed every time I was in the ring with him. I know Bobby was probably in the ring with him.
Oh yeah.
And him and Spears together. Him and Spears together were good. And of course that his manager Homer. You know, that was another deal. But I enjoyed just even, you know, if I wasn't in the ring with him, being around him, because, you know, he was always on top, and I was blessed that I got to be in, you know, some single matches with him and some tag matches with him. But he was a fair guy in that ring. You know, he was always fair with whoever he was in there, no matter whether he was a Georgia champion or whatever he was. You know, he gave everybody a chance with him, and I always appreciated that from him.
Bobby?
Not a lot you can add to what Jerry said. He was, you know, as a referee, he never middled you. You know, he got his own heat. He didn't depend on you to get it for him. And he was the same every night. It didn't matter where, you know, if you were in the biggest town we had or the smallest spot show, he was the same every night.
He worked hard too, didn't he, Bobby?
Yeah, he did. He did everywhere we went. When I first came over working for the Atlanta office after working with Ann, some of the best matches that I had when I first got started would be the nights I'd get a chance to work with him and Rocky Johnson. Him and Rocky had some heck of a matches. And I always thought it was funny when they would have the boxing matches, because I don't think Buddy enjoyed those, but they were always entertaining anyway.
Jay, do you ever – you probably weren't around, Buddy.
Well, somewhat, you know, I remember when I first saw him, as Jerry had mentioned, he was initially managed by Homer Odell. But he had that classic bleach blonde look, as mentioned, and that sneer and the laugh that he had. He was just a great heel, and he was good with the mic. He had a little slight lisp that he would use sometime in his interviews, and I think it was just part of the work. But and the tights that he wore, the long tights, he just had that great look. And when the All-South split came about, he had been a known quantity here, so he was brought in, and there was three Friday nights that he had main events with Bob Armstrong, you know, who stuck with the Atlanta office, and those were some of the matches, I think, that were used to give Armstrong a push, but also with Colt being a known quantity to kind of start trying to build the audience back there after All South had taken all the crew that most of the Atlanta fans knew. And he always did a good job. Of course, I've talked before, and we've talked about the plane crash and in 75 and how it affected a lot of different people, and it ended his career. I saw him later on down at the Atlanta City Auditorium after he had quit working as a referee and manager and a few other things, and talked to him a few minutes backstage. And he was very nice, and I was glad to have the opportunity to talk to him and on the Atlanta City Auditorium stage after his, you know, active career was over with, and to see that he was doing so well at the time.
Next up on the list, you're one of the most hated heels for a little bit here, and then a hugely popular guy after a babyface turn, El Mongo.
I don't think he wasn't over. He was over. Him and Danny Jack, I'm telling you, gosh, I don't know if you heard him on our show that night, Rich. Did you hear him?
Yep.
He was, he looked the part, and he could, I don't know. He was over. That's all I can say. He was over. He was over. And I'm sure for the time that he was here, you know, he made as much money as anybody at that time. And, I mean, he was over in the whole state and never had to say a word. You know, he had Dandy Jack and he had it made there. But they were heck of a duo, the two of them. I thought they were.
Yeah, as a kid going to the matches, man, he when they brought him in here, you know, Crawford did all the talking. You know, the deal was he couldn't speak English. He was from Peru, and he couldn't speak English, didn't understand English. So Crawford did all the talking, and Crawford, you know, he always wore a tuxedo, had his little hat and his cane, and he was very egotistical in his interviews, and just people hated them. And then you put that with the fact that the Mongo could get in the ring and he could work, and you know, it was just he had great runs, man. I can remember as a kid he had great runs with Dick Kozak, with Tim Woods, Mr. Wrestling, just any babyface they brought in here and they'd put him in there, man. You know, that was before his run, if I remember correctly, was just before the Torres brothers came in here, and then it sort of became a tag team.
Yes.
Run here for a while.
How long was his run, Rich? It was long.
He was in here late 66. I want to say late 66 and through 68. He was working as a heel. He went away. They did an angle where they did a deal where, I can't remember, I wrote a big article on it earlier this year, and it should be at the top of my head, but it's not right now. They did a big deal where basically he ended up on the wrong side of Dandy Jack, and Dandy Jack sold his contract to, what was it, Peruvian Promotions Limited, and that banished him, you know, to wrestle only in Lima, Peru for a certain amount of time. That was the angle they had going on. I'm guessing he was probably in Japan or something. I don't know. But when he came back, and it was basically sold for about a month that he was coming back, and basically he was looking for Dandy Jack. So I want to say it was early 69, January 69. That's exactly it. January 69, he came back. And basically feuded with anybody Dandy Jack could put in front of him. And he was basically wrestling everybody to get his hands on Dandy Jack. And that lasted pretty much through the year. I can't remember off the top of my head how long he was here. I want to say it was into 1970, maybe 71. And I'm thinking he came back a little bit either right before the split or after the split.
He worked for All South after the split a little bit.
Yeah,
there we go.
And, you know, I think later on folks remembered him as much from the photo in the weekly magazine for Maria's Restaurant, where he'd be seen there. But I can remember that, you know, after he was his kind of last tour, when he was a babyface toward the end of his career there, and you know, he was working a lot of four-man tags because he, you know, didn't have this. You would assume based on his age, he could work, but he couldn't, you know, work a long period of time. But so he'd do the tag matches, but they'd have the hot tag where his partner would be, you know, getting beat, and he'd come in, and when he did, he would grin with his teeth. And you know, go down into his squatting position, and the crowd would just go wild. You know, that was it. And short, usually he would you know, get the win shortly after that point with whoever was in the ring with him. But yeah, he was always fun to watch.
Next up on the list, this guy was a former Georgia Tech football star, and if I'm not mistaken, I believe it's football that he's in for. I know he was, I think he was like a two or three sport star, and I think it's football that he's in the Georgia Tech Athletic Hall of Fame for. Frank Spear. He was actually a pro wrestler. I don't know that he ever played in the NFL, but he was a pro wrestler in the late 20s, early 30s, and he was actually sort of run things for Henry Weber when Henry Weber, who we've talked about here in this series earlier, when Henry Weber was ill and didn't look good for him, and up until the time he passed away, Frank Spear was actually running Atlanta for him, and he just kind of took over after Weber died, and he actually ran it until his own death in June of 1938. And at that time, he was only 32 years old. But he'd been promoting basically during the 30s. And he died June 10th, 1938, of bronchial pneumonia. So kind of an early death, but he'd done a lot around basically, I think, I want to say from 1929 through 1938. I don't know if Bobby's familiar with anything he did at Georgia Tech.
I don't know anything about him.
Okay. But, yeah, he's in the Georgia Tech Athletic Hall of Fame, and I want to say it's for football. But I'm thinking he was two or three sports star, and I'm guessing wrestling was one of them. Did you start to say something? All right, next up on the list, I don't know how this guy got here, Jay West, the man with the golden voice.
Well, I called in earlier. That's how I got on here, you know. You may have forgotten it's been, you know, an hour or so, but called the number.
I want to say you got voted in just strictly for the suits you wore and that beard.
Anybody can pull them leisure suits off. You know, they deserve to be in a Hall of Fame.
Good Lord.
Well,
I saw people dress bad in the 70s until I saw his picture. Then I just figured out it was just him.
Well, I'll tell you something else, too. Anybody that could deal with Freddie Miller on a consistent basis, working in close quarters like Jay did, they deserve a medal.
Yes, they do.
I love Freddie, but Freddie was very hyper, and Freddie was a bit flaky at times, and Jay always seemed to maintain his composure and just deal with Freddie. So,
I have a feeling that
Jay was a class act. Jay was a class act.
Yeah, I have a feeling that has something to do with the military and being around musicians.
Well, the military helped with the discipline. The musician end of it helped with just kind of rolling with the flow, but, you know, not ever expecting anything to go like you wanted it to go and just take it as it was. I don't know how I got into the Hall of Fame, but I certainly appreciate it. I will say that, you know, I'm from East Point. I'm a Georgia boy and went to Headland High School locally, and two things that I wanted to do was be a musician, and then I wanted to go into broadcasting. And Freddie Miller was one of my, you know, it sounds kind of cornball now, but he was one of the guys that I looked at on TV when I was young. And so he was an influence, as was Skinny Bobby Harper and Red Jones and Ed Caprell. And I had, you know, I had seen wrestling on TV as a kid, early Dumont, and you know, I watched live Atlanta wrestling, and so while I was doing radio, it was an opportunity that came about, and Jim Bell had recommended me, and Freddie called me, and I got a chance to use what I considered some of my vocal skills to add to the TV show, and I think I did a little bit, and I enjoyed it immensely. And you know, as much as you can, I made some good friends. Charlie Smith was the first guy that that I really really knew. I'd seen him on TV and got to, and I met him at a show we did, a country music show, and so I developed a lifelong friendship with him. And you know, and of course Charlie will tell you any time that he gets the opportunity that, as Dandy Jack used to say, it's you know, the pleasure is all his. I you know, Charlie's a dear friend. Bobby, I love. I'm glad we had the opportunity in the early 2000s to start getting together a little bit again. And we've lost a few since that time, and that just makes it more special to know that some of us are still around. And I got to introduce both Jerry and his brother, Ted, many times at the Atlanta City Auditorium and sometimes at the Omni. And so having this opportunity to, you know, talk about old times and to do it in what is considered the communications that we have today, which is online, it's just really a joy to do this, and I'm really glad to have the opportunity to get together with you guys occasionally and talk about the old days.
Well, you was always such a professional at what you did, Jay. I mean, you really were. You were just an asset to what we all did.
Well, I thank you very much, Jerry.
That's the truth. You had that voice, and you know, you did a wonderful job.
You know, aside from all that too, just the announcing. You know, you wrote a really nice piece on Mr. Wrestling too that ended up. I think it was something to do with his retirement, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was a yes.
Actually, turned out to not be a retirement. But,
you know. I did several articles for the what was Norm Keitzer's and Jim Melsby's, which was another avenue that I had there. To write some stories and for the wrestling news that became actually the Ring Wrestling towards the end of its run, and so it was a national publication at that time. And two was a story that I got to do mostly through background. One that I did, which was a one-on-one interview, was the story that I did with Gordon Solie. And I got a chance to sit down and talk with Gordon one morning at the TV station, and that was an interview that I just thought was great to have a chance to talk with him and then put that information into publication. I did several others with some known people and some that weren't. A guy named Bobby Garrett that some of you remember from the 70s. I did a little story on him, and I did one on Lars Anderson and one on Doug Smith when he was promoting. So it ran the gamut, but it was another outlet that I had for discussing professional wrestling. I did one on the plane crash that Buddy Colt and Bobby Shane were in. I did a story on it that was tied around the North American title. And so it was just, you know, it was good. It just was one more of the things that I could check off of my bucket list of things that when I was young I wanted to say I had done, and I enjoyed it.
You know, those aftermags, man, they were so much better than the aftermags. I'm sorry. The Bill After magazine, you know, they were great for Flash, but I used to love walking into the lower tier stores, I guess you could say, and finding those on the shelves. The first time I found those, and man, I fell in love with those.
Well, you know, they started the Melby Keitzer stuff started as a fan type magazine. You know,
right.
That was an only subscription, and a lot of the territories didn't particularly care for them because you know, they they were insider. They didn't give away the business, but unlike the after magazines, the information that was there was at least what actually took place. And with the after magazines, what you would see was pictures that had been sent in from some say Atlanta or the Carolinas or somewhere, or California, and the story that was written about it was totally fictitious, but it was put together by their writers. But with Keitzer's publications, when Jim Melby was editing it, what you saw was the local writer with the pictures that they had from that particular promotion. That's what the story was written about. And believe me, I can tell you, I had stories that were sent back to me two or three times before they were satisfied that Jim Melby was satisfied that that was going to cut mustard, because he wasn't going to put anything into the magazine that that wasn't legit from the standpoint of that's what actually took place. And unlike the magazines that sold real well at that time, and of course, like you said, they were flashy, and I bought plenty of them, so I can tell you that I was a hardcore fan, so I can tell you that the after mag sold, but the Keitzer publications were where you got your real education on what the business was about without giving it away.
Right, far more informative. And being able to keep up with more than just the top four or five territories that after covered,
that was one of the problems that the booking offices had with the publication, because when you looked at it, for example, a guy could say he was injured, and in fact he was working somewhere else, and you could see it from those publications.
Right. All right. Next up on the list, guys. As a set of brothers, the Monroes, Sputnik, Rocket, and Flash. I'm going to let Bobby lead this one.
Well, of course, Rocket, I one of the best friends I've ever had in my life. We met when I was 14 years old, and me and him just absolutely hit it off the first time we ever met, and for whatever reason, my mother liked him. She wasn't real keen on me spending all my weekends at the wrestling. She didn't mind me going on Friday nights, but when I started putting the ring up and working on Griffin on Saturday night, tearing tickets and stuff, she thought I was spending too much time. But she met Rocket, liked him, trusted him for whatever reason, and she would let me go spend the weekend and make trips with him. And a lot of times he'd call me and say, "Hey, kid, I'm going to Augusta, or I'm going here. You want to go? Meet me at the exit ramp, at your exit ramp there in an hour." And he'd get off the expressway and pick me up, and we'd go to town, and he would bring me home at night. We were friends to the day he died. Never had a crossword between us. Sputnik I met when I was about 16. I saw him work many times as a kid, and I was afraid of him. He was the big heel probably before El Mongo. For whatever reason, this is burned into my mind, maybe because I'd never seen so much blood in my life. It's first night in Atlanta at the City Auditorium. He worked with a guy named Guy Taylor, and he hardwayed him. And, of course, I didn't know anything about hardways as a kid, but found out later on. But I've never seen so much blood in my life. And I was afraid of him, man. I thought he was crazy. I thought he'll chew a little kid up and spit him out. But I actually met him when I was 17. Me and Rocket went to the airport and picked him up one Friday night. He was coming in to do a deal on TV on Saturday, and we got to the airport, and he was so drunk we had to help him in the car. And Rocket went on to share with me that the guy probably could have made millions of dollars if he could have controlled the bottle. Became friends with Sputnik, not as close as Rocket, but we were friends. I would see him every year at the Mobile reunion, and I was glad that I got to know him a little bit. My friend Danny Goddard was the president of Rocket and Sputnik's fan club when he was a kid in high school, and Danny is now a Church of the Nazarene minister, and he got to fly. He flew down into Louisiana and did Sputnik's funeral. But Flash, I got to know Flash just a little bit. Not very close to Flash at all. Didn't know him that well, but Flash was the three of them together in any combination. And there's one more. I mean, you kind of got to throw Norvell Austin in that mix too, because Norvell kind of fell in there with him as a partner for the last few years of their career together. But they drew heat everywhere they went. Were a good team. My favorite Rocket line of all times was after a match between Rocket and Flash and Tom and Jody. They had worked a heel angle where they were working against each other. And Rocket went up to Jody and he said, "Jody, I thought that was a good match. What did you think?" And Jody's remark to him was, "I've had easier street fights." So, they were good guys. They were very talented. Sputnik, there's story after story after story about Sputnik and the things he did and the things he accomplished over the years. And they're as deserving as anybody I know to be in a Hall of Fame.
Jerry?
I had a lot of matches with Rocket and Flash. Tag matches. I had a lot of tag matches with them here in Georgia, a lot of single matches with them. Flash was the bigger of the three. I don't know how much you were around him, Bobby, but he was a different kind of guy, but he's
yeah.
hard worker. And I know they drew a lot of money here in Georgia, Rocket and Flash did.
Yep.
And they were the only two guys that I ever knew that lived in Macon.
Yeah.
They lived in, and it made sense.
Sure it did.
Of course, Ted and I always lived in Columbus, but they lived, it was in the center of the state, and to me it was the perfect place to live, but... Yeah, I enjoyed working with Rocket. I was a lot of single matches with Rocket. Rocket worked hard, and as a team, I was never involved with anything with Sputnik as a team, but just I was around him a lot. But the stories that man had, I mean, he told me one night he was in a loser leave town in Detroit with the Sheik. He pulled into the Cobo Arena with a U-Haul trailer behind him. That sounds like something he would do, you know.
Yeah.
Because he was leaving, you know. But he had. But after he was around Sputnik for about a week, he started repeating himself with his stories, you know. But
yeah,
he could tell them. But to me, the best team out of the three of them was Rocket and Flash.
Yeah.
Now, that's my opinion. Sputnik was, I think, better as an individual. That's just my opinion.
Jay, did you get much exposure to these guys in any combination?
Mostly as a fan, but, we've talked a pretty good bit in the last several weeks about Rocket and Sputnik. Flash and Rocket, in addition to here, had a pretty good run, I think, in the Gulf Coast. Mike Norris could probably, talk for days about it. But the first time I saw a picture of Flash, it was in one of those After magazines, and he was working in the Mid-Atlantic area as in a different persona. J.C. Dykes was his manager, and he was doing some type of gimmick where he had a bee sting. And that was the first thing I ever saw in him in a magazine. And then, of course, later on, he came back as Flash Monroe, which he had been before. But the last time I saw him was at the auditorium, and this was late. And he was doing photography. And I remember having meeting him backstage, and he just introduced himself with his real name, and he said he was taking pictures there that night, and what it was pictures of Tommy Rich with the girls from the audience that wanted to come up and pay big bucks to have their money, to have their picture taken with Tommy. So they had that set up backstage, and he was doing that night, and I don't know how many places he went around and took pictures of Tommy Rich with some of the fans, but that was the last time I ever saw Flash. But overall, all three of them in whatever combination, and I think Bobby was right in mentioning Norville Austin there also, that they were always great to watch, and you got your money's worth when you came to see them.
And last person on our list for this week for the 2008 class, not in the late 70s and early 80s in Georgia, there were few guys that could get over as much as this guy, Tony Atlas.
Tony Atlas. I met Tony for the first time in 1975 in Kansas City. He wasn't out there but maybe a week, 2 weeks. He was big then, but not near as big as he got. And, but, you know, he was out there just, you know, learning. And he got a lot of breaks, Tony did. Tony made a lot of money. He got a lot of breaks in the Carolinas. He got a lot of breaks here. And he was an impressive guy, fun guy to be around, too. You know, Tony was easy to get along with. He finally learned the business, you know, pretty well. And I think he did go to New York, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how well he did up there, but he, you know, he had a lot of breaks. And, you know, of course, he did look the part. And he was in the Carolinas when we were up there. And Tony was fun to be around. He was a fun guy. I always enjoyed Tony. I know Bobby was around him.
Yeah, Tony was his own worst enemy, and it wasn't necessarily his fault.
Absolutely,
he was his own worst enemy. He was cast into a situation. Here's a guy that young guy that was cast into a business, and he because of the looks. And because not so much because of the ability, but because of the looks, because he was black, and they were looking for a black baby face at the time, that all of a sudden he was cast into a main event, semi-main event role, where he started making a lot of money, and he just bottom line didn't know how to handle it.
He did not know
how to handle it. And he was very, very vulnerable to the people that he hung around with, and they got him mixed up in some things that he probably shouldn't have been mixed up in, and things kind of spiraled out of control for him. I had the privilege of refereeing a lot of his matches. I got the privilege to work with him one night under a mask. I went over to Carrollton and worked with Tony, and he's very easy to work with. I mean, I didn't have any problem with him at all, and you know, he just was. He was a follower rather than a leader, and that sometimes proves to be a problem. I talked to Tony here a few years ago. He came down and he worked a match down in Macon for Grady Odom, and we had a chance to talk, and I asked him about a thing that happened. Paul Bosch was looking for a black babyface to work with Harley Race in Houston, and they used we sent some tapes out there of Tony, and they used them on Houston TV, and we cut some interviews. And Tony flew out on a Friday to work with Harley Race in Houston. And he went out there, and the way they set the deal up, they worked a return, and they won an hour. Paul Bosch called the Atlanta office on Monday morning and told me to make sure that Barnett knew that he had paid Tony $3,000 cash money plus his trans in Houston on Friday night. And we had Tony on a guarantee here of, I think at the time it was $1,200. And I called Jim and told Jim what he had told me, and I said, do I give him the $1,200 or I give him just what he made? Because he didn't make that much here, of course, not working in Atlanta on Friday night. And we gave him the $1,200. That was his guarantee, so we gave it to him. So between Friday and Monday morning, he made $4,200. And he came in, he got his check that morning, and I'll never forget him looking at me and going, you just can't make any money in this business. And he kicked the front door and knocked the front door of the Sports Arena off its hinges as he was leaving. And I asked him about that, and he did not remember it. And he told me that night, he said, Bobby, he said, I was so messed up on drugs. He said, I don't know what I made and what I didn't make. He said, I do not remember doing that. And I said, well, I said, it happened. I said, but, you know, I knew, you know, that that wasn't you. But it wasn't just Tony. There was a lot of guys that was cast into that position where they made a lot of money, didn't know how to handle it, and they were very vulnerable to the people that they hung around with. And that's, you know, those of us that I never made the money that a lot of those guys made, but I was very fortunate. I'll just be honest, I was afraid of my mama. So there was a lot of things I just wasn't going to do because I did not want to let her down.
Well, that's the way he was raised, Bobby. And I'm going to tell you something about Paul Bosch. If he called you and told you that, that's exactly what he paid him.
Oh, I know it.
That man, let me tell you something, that man paid. He paid. And, you know, a lot of these guys, they were blessed and didn't know it.
Yep, exactly right. Tony told me he got so down, he was living on a park bench. He said he lost everything he had, and he had hit rock bottom. And Tony is 61, 62 now, maybe 63. I'm not sure what he's actually. I know he's in his early 60s. But he told me, he said the best thing that ever happened to him, he met and married a German woman. She is in her early 80s. She's 10 years or 20 years older than Tony is. He told me, he said, that woman saved my life. He said, she don't put up with no foolishness. She tells him just how it's going to be. And he said, I learned to say yes, ma'am. And he said, she saved my life.
What's he doing now, Bobby?
He still works independent shows periodically. I think he might be running a little gym up there somewhere outside of Boston, somewhere up there where he lives. He was doing some things for Vince up until recently. He's just keeping his hand in the business where he can, but I think he's running a little gym up there too.
That area up there, they have a lot of those autograph-type sessions and things where guys can work doing that, you know. When he first came in, he was under a mask as the Black Atlas.
Yep.
And, you know, you could think some guys, you line them up and put a mask on them and take it off, and you might not, you know, say for sure, yeah, that's that guy. But not many people you could put a mask on Tony Atlas and then take it off and not realize that's who it was. But that's how he came in before he was Mr. USA. He worked a lot with Tommy Rich and wrestling, too. One of the things that I remember was one Friday night at the auditorium, superstar Billy Graham came in from New York for a couple of shots. And we did a thing where they were doing a posing contest with Tony against superstar Billy Graham. And anyway, they were going to be in the ring, and they were going to do a pose, and then I was supposed to ask the audience who did the best. Well, you know, back during that time, there wasn't, you know, you knew for sure that the audience was going to go for the baby face. Today, it would be a different story. But at any rate, Doug Smith, who was in charge that night, he said, okay, after they do the pose, then ask the audience, you know, who they like best or who did the best job. And we went through the thing, and it went like it was supposed to. But it was interesting because literally it was a shoot because it was possible that it would have gone the other way. And I thought for sure at the end, after Tony was declared the winner, that Graham was going to turn over the weights because they had weights set up on a bench in the ring. But he did not do it. You know, he did a few more poses and left the ring, and then Tony did a couple more and left also. But that was interesting that night because, you didn't see that happen too much. But that was the first opportunity that I saw, other than on TV, was superstar Billy Graham that night. And then he came in and worked, you know, several shots before he went back. But Tony always put on a good show. He was good draw, not only with the minorities, but the mainstream crowd. And like Bobby said, he got too much too soon. But that's just life. It's not just him that happened to. It happened to many, and not only just this business that we're talking about, but a lot of other businesses, too. Some people handle it better than others do. I never had the money, so I never had to worry about it.
Money is no object at my house. I don't have any, so I don't have to be objective about it.
And if I did have any, I was always too afraid of the IRS. I knew how they worked. You know, if you made some money, you better tell them about it. If you don't, they're going to find out about it.
Luke Graham had a saying. He said that there had to be an easier way to make a living, but he was too nervous to steal.
Guys, anything else to add for this class?
I think they're pretty well covered.
All right, anything else you guys want to get in before we wrap up for the evening?
It's been a while since we got together. I was certainly glad to do this tonight. I will mention this to Bobby as he's talked about. I'm once again sorry about the kitty cat, but I've got two that were banging on the door out here. They were wondering why I was sequestered in the room, and so I opened the door a couple of times to let them see that I was okay. So that's just how it is with animals sometimes. You just really, really develop a bond with them.
Yeah,
there's no doubt about that.
But I was happy we all were able to do the show tonight.
Yeah, me too.
Well, guys, at this point, we're sort of at the mercy of the baseball schedule, unfortunately. But luckily, we don't have any games scheduled for the next few weeks, next couple of weeks with spring break and stuff going on. And hopefully... Hopefully next week. I can tell you the week after that, I got a business trip going on. I am supposed to be back on Thursday of that week. So if there's no game scheduled, then we'll be able to do maybe 3 weeks in a row.
All right.
Sounds good to me.
All right.
Let
guys.
Me know.
Well,
I'm ready.
What's that?
Just let me know. I'm ready.
All right. Thanks for everybody for listening to us tonight or on the archive. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we hope you are enjoying the continuing series. Obviously, we got five more classes to go through, so be sure to join us next time. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Thanks a lot. See you next
time.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.